Now, kombucha felt a bit like the Benedict Cumberbatch of foodstuffs for a while. It was everywhere. But there's a history to our love of fermentation. We're going to get medieval on that in a moment on Life Matters.
Know your emergency plan this summer.
A third consecutive London year.
And rely on ABC to be with you.
What can I do?
Broadcasting up-to-the-minute critical information.
We have issued an emergency warning.
Online at ABC Emergency and on your local ABC Radio.
ABC Radio, reliable source for information.
Stay safe, stay connected.
I don't know what I'd do without the ABC.
Download the ABC Listen app and stay connected with your local ABC radio station.
Sometimes it feels like kombucha exploded into our consciousness as the exciting new fermented product of the moment. But it's actually got a millennia-long history, along with other fermented drinks like mead and cider and kvass. Fermenting master Sharon Flynn says drinking and making these drinks can connect us with that history and be tasty too. I have to say, I might need some convincing on that. I just don't like the taste of kombucha. Maybe I'm missing something. Send me a text. Your experience with fermented drinks. Should I get on board that wagon? 0418 226 576. Sharon Flynn has five fridges full of water kefir in her garage. She's one of Australia's leading authorities on fermentation. And her new book is called Wild Drinks, the new old world of small batch brews, ferments and infusions. Sharon, great to chat with you. Hi.
Hi, how are you going?
Good. Now, you've lived in quite a few different countries and sampled their different kind of fermented foodstuffs. What drew you to fermentation in the first place?
It's hard to say what draws you to a thing, but definitely there'd be that there's sort of the science-y aspect, I think, the magic in the process of it. You can take 10 minutes to set something up and it will take 3 months, for example, to finish. But the bacteria are used to doing all of that themselves for you. As long as you set the environment up the right way, they're doing it. So that's fairly appealing to me, I think. I think I like long-term projects because I moved around a lot as well. So
yeah, so Malaysia, parts of Europe. How did things differ from place to place when it came to what fermented products people enjoyed?
Well, it would also depend on how old I was in the place.
Oh, yeah.
And what I was exposed to. But I think we all, it's very, very similar, actually. There's an undercurrent of the same processes and the same ingredients. All fermentation relies on an aspect of sugar, whether that's sugar from a cabbage or the sugar from honey or within bread. So we have all of those things all over the world. So, you know, maybe in Russia it's using bread to make a drink, and in Japan it's using rice to make a drink. Whatever the staple starch is, I guess you'll find that around the world, drinks made from starches that are easily accessible.
Well, you mentioned that it seems a bit like magic, and it does. What is actually happening? What are the physics, the magic physics of what's going on in fermenting?
Well, it depends on what you're brewing, obviously. But, you know, there's always a combination of enzymes and bacteria, the range of, usually in this case, it's lactoferment, lactic acid bacteria. And then there's a wide range of yeasts. So in what I do, well, it's why the book is called Wild Drinks, is that I like to rely on the yeasts and bacteria that's already there. So we don't buy anything. I don't encourage people to buy a packet of, you know, starter culture or something like that. We don't talk about buying yeasts from a homebrew store. It's how they capture yeast that's on the environment, in and on the vegetable or whatever you're fermenting. So, you know, as long as you've got a sugar, for example, we take rice, the enzymes will go in and convert the starch in the rice to glucose, which will then feed the yeast that love simple sugars and the bacteria, and they'll spit out carbon dioxide, which is the fizz, they'll spit out a bit of alcohol, and then sourness, which is lactic acid bacteria. Is that clear?
Yeah, that makes sense. But it also raises a couple of questions for me. It's making my kind of fridge anxiety go off big time. You know, when you take something out of the fridge and it's bubbling and tastes fizzy on your tongue, that's a signal to me to throw it out. Is it ever dangerous?
No, I don't. You know what? I don't think so. I think what I'm after is to teach people that, in fact, we've only had fridges in our homes for a very short part of our journey as humans. Like, you know, one or two generations now, three. So what did we do before that? Before that, we even had raw milk and no refrigeration. So our common sense has kind of started to be lost on us all. So, you know, you can open something up and it might be a little fizzy. So what? I mean, taste it, look at it. Think about how long it's been there. Is that actually dangerous? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I guess most of us don't have the scientific knowledge, though, to work it out whether it's dangerous.
It's not science. It's not science. It's knowledge. It's your DNA. It's like we've been eating and preparing food for ourselves for a long time, and it's passed down. And I don't think you necessarily need scientific knowledge. Just you need to sort of stop for a minute and become more in tune with food and your environment.
I would certainly be reading.
That's what fermentation allows, you know, for you to be. There's a little more. Well, I guess the invisible. And if you think of just a simple sauerkraut or pickles, everyone knows, you've got your vegetable, and normally we'd cut something up and use heat to transform it. In this case, we're using something that's a little more, well, we could say it's invisible, so you don't really have huge control over the bacteria on there. So it's a step away from yourself, I guess. You're saying, I'm going to put the cucumbers in here with some salt water and trust that nature will take its course. It's really similar to maybe putting a seed in the soil, and that's all you can do. And you have to trust that the nature will take its course. And I guess in saying that is what I love about fermenting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love in the book that it's a celebration of, you know, wild drinks, living drinks. This fact that there's activity going on. I guess my concern is that we shouldn't be encouraging people to eat fizzy things out of the fridge if they're not absolutely sure that they're safe. But you also mentioned, Sharon Flynn, the fact that a lot of fermented things, or all fermented things, have some amount of alcohol in them. How does that shape how you approach your kombucha at home? Is it an amount of alcohol that you need to be mindful of?
No, it's usually quite small. I mean, there's alcohol even in milk kefir, naturally made milk kefir. You know, there's a lot of sugar in milk that we call lactose. We've had ours measured at, you know, sometimes it's 0.8%. So it depends on the amount of sugar that you feed your brew, because sugar is what will make alcohol. So with kombucha, and you know, maybe 10 years ago when it first really hit the markets, people were unaware that there was a little bit of alcohol in there. And we were made aware that actually the laws around governing Australia are very different state to state. So they're not health regulation laws, they're more tax laws. So, you know, the guidelines for Australia wide would be, from the health and food safety point of view, is 1.15% and under is deemed a soda and non-alcoholic. But a lot of kombucha sits at around 1.5, so it's just over. And because of that, actually, the kombucha that you're buying from the supermarkets is no longer the real deal. So really, if you want to get a gorgeous tasting kombucha, you need to make it yourself or find someone who's doing it really well in, say, a farmer's market situation or something like that.
Mm, really good to be aware of that, the alcohol percentage, though. That's good to know. Sharon, what does the research say in terms of what fermented drinks and foods generally bring to your gut microbiome?
Right. Well, because if you're making a naturally fermented drink, so not the supermarket bought kombuchas I was just talking about, really, but if you're making them at home, they have all of those bubbles and things like that are living bacteria. And you know, we know them as probiotics, which means they're good for our gut. We don't have a lot of life in our microbiome naturally at the moment because there's chlorine in the water and taking antibiotics and things like that. So, and at the same time, a lot of us aren't putting hands in soil and getting life back into our body. So eating fermented food is a really good way of getting those good bugs into your gut. But usually they're sitting in an acidic environment. We're talking about kombucha or sauerkraut. That's already quite acidic and similar to your gut. So it has no trouble going in and sort of living in there as well, if you know what I mean.
There's going to be some people listening who think, I have enough yeast in my system. Is it a good idea to put extra fermented things? What about people who are a bit sensitive in the gut to that kind of thing?
Well, I'd recommend, you know, trying to balance it out, really, and trying to find I usually say to people, we really need a wide variety of bacteria, not a lot of one kind. So if you can try and get a lot of different ferments into your diet, so small amounts of different kinds of ferments regularly, that's what I would say. So if you're particularly sensitive, just take a small, you know, like a little 20 mils at night before going to bed perhaps, or, you know, a teaspoon of something and building up from there. But most people can enjoy a glass of something without feeling any repercussions. It's, you know, you would hope so. And if you're one of those people who have an out-of-balance system, then, yeah, it's something to work on.
I love the story in your book, Sharon Flynn, where someone came up to you at the end of a workshop and said, I have this or this condition, you know, how much of this should I take to counteract that? And you were very careful to point out that, you know, it's not a medicine. It's one healthy food among many. How does it fit in our wider diet? Would you like to see a kind of it kickstart, including fermented things, kickstart a change to the way we relate to food?
Yeah, I would. Well, I think poor fermented food, I think because it takes time. Time is the main ingredient, and that's expensive in the industrialized food system. So it got sort of hit hard early on. We were able to imitate the flavors of fermentation with other ways. And all of the ferments, you know, including kombucha today, gets pasteurized, which is heated up so that all the bacteria and the life is killed so it can be shelf stable. So I think we need to just be aware of that and know that if you want to, I think whenever you eat a fat or an oily food, try and get an acid in there. So even if it's not living, a little bit of vinegar or, you know, a lot of people are eating and drinking apple cider vinegar these days. But something acidic with a fatty, oily thing is a good way to start. And just remembering every culture from around the world has this kind of thing. When you're having a fatty dinner, you might have it, you know, think about even wine or beer, or, you know, some kinds of cordials that have vinegars in them. We've always done that, and it's only just recently that we've dropped that out. So just to try and bring that back, and it's an easy way to, if you've got veggies in your fridge that are fermented, they can stay in there and you've got them anytime you like. So that's another positive as well.
And I found it really interesting, Sharon, that you see fermenting as a feminist act. How is that, given that it can add quite a bit to the weekly domestic labour, you know, the feeding and monitoring and things?
Yeah, it is. When you put it like that, that does sound a bit strange. But no, it's because somewhere along the line, the brewing and the making of drinks sort of moved from within the kitchen to the shed. And I don't think it was because people were being helpful, you know, let me do that for you. It was taken off our hands because it was a commodity. And traditionally, actually, all around the world, women were making brews and beers and things like that as a way to supplement their income and as a way to heal their family and friends because, you know, a lot of herbs and things like that are more potent when they're in an acid or an alcohol. So it's really amazing to see. And if you've got a fennel seed, for example, but if you put it into a sauerkraut, its potency is increased because it's, you know, the acid helps it along. So we had this, whoever was cooking and had their hands in the bread and or pasta, whatever we're making, we're also making the drinks because it goes hand in hand. So I feel as though what happened was nowadays what we're left with is this very shortcut to make beer situation where, you know, you can go even in Coles now and buy packet mixed beer stuff, you know, where it's syrups and packets and mix that, and it's always in quite large quantities. And I'm sort of just here to say, bring it back. You can make it in a saucepan. You can make 5 litres at a time and really make some delicious brews that doesn't have to be something that's sort of unknown and out there and not for us, not for the kitchen. Yeah. And maybe you'd say, you know, yes, we might be cooking and that's a chore, but making drinks is a pleasure. And I think we think of drinks as something you get from a fridge in a petrol station or the supermarket, and we don't connect it with food and health necessarily. But when you're making them yourself and they're naturally sparkling and you're putting all kinds of yummy things in there, it is, it can be healthy.
Yeah.
And fun, easy, you know, fussy eaters don't always want to eat the sauerkraut and the pickle, but they will have a raspberry water kefir, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, and there's something amazing and magical about seeing the pathway from ingredient to to food product, I think, that's really nice to get back in touch with. Sharon, thanks so much for chatting to us about fermentation. It's lovely to hear the kind of passion and excitement in your voice. Thanks for your time.
No worries. Thank you.
Sharon Flynn, one of Australia's leading authorities on fermentation. Her new book's called Wild Drinks, The New Old World of Small Batch Brews, Ferments and Infusions. She's got stories in there about how they used to be mixed up with brooms and there's that witchy aspect to them before we all worked out with science what was actually happening with fermentation.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.